Chapter 8. Stumbling over the stones and roots that scarred the forest path, Jeff could hear the beat of footsteps closing in from behind. He slipped to one knee upon the soft pine needles surrounding Mr. Big, but clawed at the hard-packed ground along the ridge to avoid sliding down toward the dry ravine, all the while eyeing the dark path behind him in fear of who might be following. He passed the rabbit path leading to the underground fort to his left, but he kept to the main path, driving his legs upward against a steep slope rising to the right. A few minutes later, he reached a clearing at the top of Bobcat Hill. Breathing heavily with his hands on his knees, he stared down the path he had just climbed, knowing he could count on one hand the boys from either gang who could outrun him up a hill. A moment later, Crazy Legs emerged from the woods along the path in plain view of him.
"Don't make me keep chasing you, Jeff. I've run far enough tonight."
Jeff backed to a hilltop clearing and rested his hands on his hips. "Go away," he said breathlessly. "Stop following me." The runner slowed to a walk and circled about as he sucked in the cool air.
"Where are you going? What are we supposed to do now?"
"Figure it out for yourself. Just leave me alone."
"You said we had to stick together. What was that? A lie?"
Jeff straightened up, irked by the comment. "You want to know what to do? Get out. Find a way. Don't wait." He started away, but turned a forlorn look back to his friend. "It's too late for me now." Crazy Legs stood agape, splashed in the moonlight atop the modest hill, while Jeff darted off to the mouth of another dark path at the other side of the clearing. The short path led him downhill to the edge of an embankment 10 feet above Arrow Drive, where he waited for a car to pass before sliding down an eroded rut and crossing the street for the next yard. As he climbed the sloping backyard to a wooden fence, he felt relieved to see his home dark atop the gentle slope of the next yard, for if the news of Happy Jack's stabbing had already reached the Salisbury police, their first move surely would have been to seek out the most obvious suspects. As he crossed the fence and jogged toward his house, he vowed that this time they would not find him there. He hurried up the unlit porch stairs and burst through the unlocked back door, kicking it shut once inside. A flick of a switch lit a pendant lamp over the kitchen table, and stretching his arms out beneath the bright bulb, he discovered the right sleeve of his hurricane jacket was streaked with blood, as well as his underlining t-shirt. Quickly, he stripped to his waist, rolling the soiled clothing into a ball as he left the kitchen and bounding down 2 flights of stairs. He left the light off as he slid into his bedroom, stuffing the bloody clothing under the bed before grabbing a blue polo shirt and a black pullover sweatshirt from his dresser. After donning both articles, he ripped a green down vest from a closet hanger and rushed out of the bedroom barely a minute after he entered it, pulling the vest over his shoulders as he climbed the stairs 2 at a time on his way back to the kitchen. He stopped at the kitchen sink and switched on an overhead light to inspect his hands. A few specks of blood spotted the white adhesive tape of the dressed left hand, but the bandage remained intact, and there was no time to change it anyway. There was some dried blood on his right hand, but under a gush of hot water he was able to scrub it off with soap and a sponge. He was not oblivious to the fact that he was washing blood from his hands for the second time in a week, but he wondered if he could scrub his conscience of Happy Jack's stabbing as easily as he scrubbed the blood from his skin. A flick of a switch killed the sink light, and barely 3 minutes after entering the house, he was at the back door again, ready to turn off the last remaining kitchen light. As he reached for the switch, however, a shimmering object in the dining room caught his eye, a crystal decanter set upon the middle shelf of a corner curio cabinet. "That's it," he thought. "Perfect." He entered the dining room and stepped around the cherry wood table to the matching glass cabinet set in the far corner of the room. Amid the trinkets and keepsakes placed upon the mirrored shelves was a silver-framed wedding photo of his mother and father set beside a crystal decanter of Scotch whiskey. Jeff wistfully recalled the last time his parents drank from that bottle, toasting their 15th and final wedding anniversary, following an elegant candlelit dinner while he and his brother gleefully looked on. The sentiment vanished. He threw the cabinet door open and callously brushed the picture frame aside, grabbing the crystal decanter by its neck before turning about and charging from the room. With a flick of the light switch, He plunged the house into darkness again and closed the back door. Moments later, he squeezed through a gap in the hedges, heading toward the grounds of Salisbury High with the bottle tucked beneath his vest. He continued through a half dozen backyards, stirring a dog into barking, but otherwise traveling undetected to the curb of Willow Street, where he took cover behind a bush from the headlights of an approaching car. The car passed by and he sprang forward, holding the decanter safely in his good hand as he crossed the street for the dormant high school recreational fields. Following the left foul line of a baseball field, he passed the outfield fence and skirted the edge of a basketball blacktop to the tall meshed fences of three dark tennis courts, their monolithic spotlight poles silent and gray against the clearing sky. At the edge of the farthest tennis court, a dirt road led to a distant cul-de-sac of upscale homes abutting the school property, but the forgotten road soon thinned into a scraggly path not wide enough to keep the pine trees on either side from mingling their branches overhead. Jeff stopped to survey his surroundings. To his left, 50 yards up a gentle hill, a post and rail fence separated the boundary of a private horse pasture from a clay oval running track near the edge of the high school property, while to his right, the soft white glow of a distant Burrow Street home flickered through the gaps in the trees. Confident of isolation from all directions, he leaned back against a thick tree and slid down its trunk to the ground, stretching his legs out comfortably and resting the decanter on his lap. He popped the glass stopper free and sniffed the whiskey inside, before raising the bottle to the moon peeking at him through the overhead branches. "Here's to a hell of a future," he said, tipping the bottle to the moon. The crystal decanter weighed heavy in his hands as he raised it to his lips, and the whiskey choked him as it rushed down his throat with all the splendor of a hot coal. Gasping and sputtering, he dropped the bottle to his lap and fought the urge to vomit. But soon the discomfort eased, and he felt a warm sensation in his belly, followed by a slight numbing in his head. "A fair exchange," he mused, "the effect of the whiskey versus the pain of drinking it." He gazed back to the moon, imagining for a moment that he sat on one of the overhead branches, looking down upon the pathetic figure propped against a tree trunk. 2 weeks ago, he'd felt larger than life, cruising through his senior year with the Hurricanes a respected underground force at Salisbury High. Now here he was, a drunk in a gutter with a bottle of whiskey in his lap. But what surprised him most was a feeling of inevitability that he would someday descend to this very place. He felt that such a notion ought to nag at him, yet lying against the trunk of a tree with his legs stretched out beneath the stars, he felt strangely at ease. Nestling back against the tree, he tilted his chin toward the sky and raised the bottle to his lips again. The whiskey still burned his throat, but not quite so much this time. Staring at the moon, he closed one eye and held up the bottle stopper to the other, marveling for a moment at the lustrous kaleidoscopic view of the refracted moonlight through the intricate cuts in the crystal glass, an altered perspective of a familiar sight. Finally, he stuffed the stopper into his vest pocket with his bandaged hand as the fingers of his good hand traced the pinwheel emblem inscribed in the face of the decanter. There was dust within the inscription, for the decanter had sat idle since his father's death 8 years ago, never moved, never touched, never enjoyed. 5 years had passed since Billy left for California, 4 years since his mother had taken the bartending job, and 3 years since he'd formed the Hurricanes, if only to break the monotony of a lonesome teenage life. There, the bottle sat on the same glass shelf, collecting dust like a sacred artifact, while a family disintegrated in its midst. "So much for skeletons in the cabinet," he murmured, raising the bottle to drink again. In one sense, the Hurricanes had saved his life, or at least his sanity after his father's death. Three friendships had helped to ease his grief. Friendships not based on sports or games, but rather upon mischief and defiance. And as a result, the framework of the Hurricanes had been formed, in practice, if not in name. They had assumed their roles instinctively. The bodyguard's muscle and devotion, the lieutenant's cunning and bravado, the scout's speed and sleuth. and they looked to him as their leader. When the Tornadoes formed in his sophomore year, their bullying ways helped the Hurricanes to form and attract more recruits. TJ and Denny joined first, followed by Axel and Brain, and finally Bumbles. Confrontations with the Tornadoes had focused the Hurricanes' attention from mischief to combat, a change that Mick readily embraced. With his help, the gang honed their fighting skills and strengthened their resolve, while the values of espionage and agility Crazy Legs promoted gradually lost favor with the gang. Admittedly, Jeff preferred fighting to running, and with a smirk he mused that if Crazy Legs spent half as much time lifting weights or hitting a punching bag as he did running around town in his fancy shorts, then maybe he'd be fit to question his leader's loyalty, especially when that leader could rub his face in the dirt easier than he could wipe it clean. Still, maybe there was something to following one's own path, even if it meant incurring the ridicule of others. Jeff eased his furrowed brow. "Fair enough," he muttered before gulping another mouthful of whiskey. No one was more apt to follow his own path than Mick. Jeff wondered with a grunt how two friends as different as Crazy Legs and Mick could still wear the same colors. As a leader, he had tried to meld the various personalities of his friends into a unified force, and the result was a cohesive and versatile gang that had gained a reputation that it was better left alone. "If only Craig could figure that out," he said. The face of his rival burned clear in his mind as he raised the bottle for another swig. Manhandling the Tornadoes had become second nature for the Hurricanes to the extent that some of his friends had lost interest in tangling with them. And with the principal members of both gangs entering their senior year, the two gangs had seemed to reach a point of mutual indifference toward each other. So before the school year started, the two leaders and their lieutenants met amid pizza and sodas at Krusty's on a Saturday afternoon to hammer out a truce that would help them tolerate each other until graduation. Hell, they had even shared a few jokes, Jeff recalled with a snort of incredulity. 3 months later, the Tornadoes had regressed beyond pesky sabotage and physical skirmishes to a new low of murder. Their motives were beyond senseless. They were downright vicious, and Craig's role in it seemed fickle at best. It just didn't make sense. Jeff could taste a revelation coming on, but another gulp of whiskey quickly dispelled it. Train lay in his grave, with Happy Jack soon to follow, and trying to decipher the Tornado's motives meant entering a labyrinth of speculation that would ultimately lead him right back to where he sat now, sitting under a tree with a bottle in his hand. A few short hours ago, Cindy had told him of a world filled with opportunity, fortune, and love, somewhere beyond the suffocating borders of Salisbury. Now he could only laugh at the thought of such a future, for a simple fingerprint from his knife or a drop of Jack's blood on his clothing could send him to prison for hard time. After years of flying in the face of the police, the irony of being arrested for murder in a fight he had intended to stop was not lost upon him. Even if he could somehow escape arrest, he knew Curly would continue to hunt him with renewed vengeance. His head swam in a warm rush of whiskey, but a sobering decision beckoned him. Stay in his hometown and risk death or arrest, or live on the lam with a glimmer of hope to remain free, but in complete exile of his current life. Jeff drew a deep breath and closed his eyes. He pictured himself driving the Camaro along a flat road with the radio playing and a warm breeze blowing through the open windows, and it felt right to him. In the morning, he would retrieve the car from its hiding spot and drive out of town, across the state and country to California, where Billy would hopefully welcome him with a room and a job in his auto body shop. Graduating with his class felt like a fading dream, but the thought of a liberating cross-country trip rekindled a spark in his heart, for he had longed for such a journey to reunite with his brother. Still, loose ends abounded. Money, clothes, and fond farewells. The Hurricanes had battled and bled with him, and as their leader, he owed each of them a handshake, if nothing else. His mother would probably object to his departure, especially if it meant dropping out of school, but hopefully she would take comfort in the idea of a brotherly reunion. Those farewells would be painful, but there was one he dreaded even more. He tilted back and swallowed another mouthful of whiskey, but neither the thrill of the adventure nor the burn of the liquor diminished the bitter task of breaking up with Cindy. The joy he had felt from their reconciliation had since been completely blown away, and now he had to concoct a half-hearted explanation of why he had to leave her. If only she would take a leap of faith and go with him. Maybe they could find more happiness together without all the pressures that life in Salisbury levied upon them. "So ask her," he blurted out before raising the bottle to his lips again. The whiskey dribbled down his chin as he laughed. Of course, there were 100 reasons why she wouldn't go, several of which he could list even before he swallowed. School, sports, friends, and family. Not to mention the fact that they hadn't even known each other 2 weeks ago. He laughed aloud at his foolish expectations. It would take him 2 months to convince her to go, if she didn't reject him outright. But why not ask? The worst she could do was say no. No. He thought with a crooked grin. The worst she could do was laugh in his face and tell him to get lost. But he planned to do that anyway. He had to ask her, if only for his own peace of mind, or else spend years languishing over what might have been. She was like a soft light in his tired eyes, cool fingers in his sweaty palm, a fresh breeze on a hot summer night. Such comforts were not so readily dismissed. Jeff exhaled a long sigh of relief. He finally had a plan, and plans always set him at ease, even the murky ones. Suddenly, he felt as if he had lingered too long under the pines, so he struggled to his feet with the help of his friendly tree. Already time ran thin, for tomorrow would be a day of preparation and farewells, and by Friday morning, he would be gone. His first farewell beckoned him from a mile away, over hills and through fields, to a place where an old friend lay, the only friend who could help resolve the resonant ache in his heart. He clasped the decanter by its neck and staggered farther down the overgrown dirt path beneath the moonlight with the flush of whiskey buzzing in his head. "I'm coming to see you, Train," he slurred. "I'm coming to visit you one last time." The clang of a heavy bell jarred Jeff awake, his body shivering and his head pounding. Without opening his eyes, he massaged his temple with his fingers, wondering why the howling wind was so cold and why a bell was clanging in his bedroom. And then the bell clanged again. The hoot of an owl convinced him that he was not in the comfort of his own bed, and his aching brain vaguely recalled staggering through an open field, drinking sloppily from a bottle, and hell-bent on some destination he had clearly failed to reach. The third ring of the bell finally prompted his bleary eyes open, although they could not readily help him to fully discern his location. Then the bell rang a fourth time, and he mustered the will to roll onto his knees and behold his surroundings. The gray outline of a distant church steeple stood against a starry sky, now devoid of its earlier lunar glow, as its bell eased into silence for yet another hour. As he struggled to stand, he stumbled over the glass decanter lying at his feet, but he caught his balance before falling to the ground. He lifted the bottle and held it up in amazement, for barely an inch of whiskey remained inside, although he couldn't tell how much he had drunk and how much had spilled. In a fit of anger, he hurled it down the hill, hoping it would smash into pieces, but it landed with a dull thud in the darkness. As his wobbly legs climbed to the top of the slope, he gazed wearily at the multitude of marble gravestones lining the other side of the hill, stretching from the rear of the church grounds to a property fence not far from the curbside of Borough Street. He shuddered as he started down the hill, mostly from the chill in the air, but partly from the notion of walking through a dark cemetery in the dead of night. When he reached the perimeter of gravestones, he found the newer markers panning to his right, so he followed them along the ridge until he came upon a gray marble stone speckled in white, set before a freshly covered grave. The grave lay atop a long, grassy slope that ran past a broad oak tree to the glowing street lamps of Borough Street 100 yards away. "Lionel James Armstrong, beloved son," Jeff read aloud, noting the bookend dates of his friend's brief life. He knelt to the ground and pivoted about to sit with his back against the side of the headstone in view of the quiet, distant road. There he remained for nearly half an hour, lamenting a friendship lost and resting his troubled mind. Finally, he felt able to answer his friend's question on that fateful night. There was no way back to good anymore. They had crossed a line from which neither friend could retreat, and there would be no redemption now. "Nice view you got here, buddy," he said, but his words stuck in his throat as he glared over his shoulder at the rectangular patch of dirt cut in the grass before the marker. A bouquet of white roses lay at the base of the stone, clinging together against the onslaught of the cold November wind. Maybe more flowers would come, and more after that. But eventually, a day would arrive where there would be no more flowers. Sod would take root on the grave, and more new tombstones would dot the hillside, the inevitable result of a burgeoning and ever-aging township. Who would visit this grave when Train was nothing more than a skeleton in a memory? Who would remember his heroic act when 20 or 30 years had passed? "I will. I'm gonna do right by you, Train. I don't know how, but I will." Jeff stood up and rested his palm on the tombstone. "And I won't forget what you did for me. I swear." A stiff wind cut through his open vest like a ghost through a windsock, sending a shiver up his spine. He felt as if he teetered between two worlds, separated only by a nick of time, a minuscule happenstance of fate that determined who lived and who died. What mortal mind could predict how knives might cut and bullets might fly? Certainly not his own, for he had twice washed blood from his hands despite wishing death upon no one. Deep down, he knew the Reverend was right. The man with the plan, the one his friends admired so much, was just a fool in a fog, a battered flag flailing against the relentless force of a majestic storm. The wind offered cool relief to his bloodshot eyes as he turned to face the gentle slope again. He zippered his vest tight and glanced back at his friend's tombstone one last time before walking down the slope for Borough Street and the town of Salisbury, where the morning sun would soon rise again upon the land of the living. Even in the early dawn hours, a passing car was not an uncommon sight along the arterial road of Borough Street, so Jeff followed the road under the cover of trees and bushes away from the roadside. With the center of town nearly 2 miles behind him, he approached the fork of Arrow Drive, walking as briskly as he could with the hangover he bore. He wanted to follow Borough Street to the left and retrieve the Camaro from its hiding place near the upper plaza, but he realized that, in his rush to leave the house, he had left his car keys and cell phone rolled up inside his hurricane jacket under his bed. Following a dry gully along Arrow Drive, he soon reached the curb of Willow Street, quickly crossing it for the backyards of Spruce Lane and Hurricane Territory once again. Minutes later, he slipped through the hedges of his own backyard, relieved to find the house dark, although he knew that his mother would surely be home and in bed at such a late hour. Rather than risk a confrontation by entering through the back door, he continued to the far side of the house, where the garage window slid open with its usual ease. He climbed inside and closed the window behind him before following the familiar path through the dark garage to the basement door. Holding his breath, he eased the door open slowly and tried to minimize its predictable squeak as he squeezed it shut. He slunk to his bedroom and switched on the light, but when he reached under his bed for the stashed garments, he felt nothing but carpet. His throbbing head strained to remember. Had he left them in the laundry room instead? As he turned to leave the bedroom, he heard the creak of a step that betrayed someone's presence. But before he could exit the room, his mother stepped into the doorway, dressed in a white terry cloth bathrobe. She glared at him with sullen, sleepless eyes, a cigarette in her left hand, and his hurricane jacket in her right. I didn't mean to wake you up.
Oh, I've been awake.
Have you seen my car keys? She sucked a deep breath through the cigarette and exhaled the smoke deliberately.
The police were here tonight. They said a boy had been stabbed and that they wanted to talk to you about it.
She held up his bloody jacket.
After they left, I found this under your bed.
It was an accident.
An accident?
She flung the jacket into his chest.
It's no accident the way you carry on with your hoodlum friends.
Jeff frowned as he fished through the pockets. He tried to kill me, Ma. She scoffed in response.
Mr. Stammer called me at work today. He said you haven't been to school all week.
He found his phone, but no keys. I'm dropping out. I don't need his bullshit anymore. She stepped closer and sniffed.
You smell like booze. Where's your father's scotch?
I drank it, Ma. I figured he didn't need it anymore. Jeff massaged his aching temple. Do you have my keys or not? The scowl on her face seemed to add 10 years to her age.
I want you out of this house today. You hear me?
Jeff simmered. Loud and clear, Ma. Just give me my keys and I'll be gone for good. She pulled the keys from her nightgown pocket and threw them at him, but he snatched them out of the air, frustrating her even further.
Get out! You're no better than the thugs who killed your father.
She turned and stormed up the staircase. Her words stung worse than a knife in his palm. He threw the jacket on the floor and stuffed the keys into his vest pocket. You're gonna regret that someday, he shouted after her. He stormed down the hallway and ripped the garage door open, flicking the light before slamming it shut behind him. Forgoing departure through the window, he instead rolled up the garage door and let it crash down with the light still on as he stormed off for the side of the house. He quickly sought the cover of the dark backyard, but he stopped when he reached the short fence at the rear of the property, his attention drawn to the porch light flicking on behind him. Straddling the rail for a moment, he watched his mother standing at the porch door window, staring out into the night after him. She switched the light off a few minutes later, and he crossed into the adjacent property as surely as if he was crossing a threshold into a new and uncertain future, with no way back home. With keys and phone secure in his vest pocket, he nonetheless realized that retrieving his car at this hour would be a mistake, for the cops on the graveyard shift would be buzzing the streets like angry hornets in search of a conspicuous Camaro. A sliver of sunlight had begun to pierce the envelope of night in the eastern sky, and soon, the people of Salisbury would embark upon their workday routines. An increase in traffic might make the roads safer for discreet travel, but until then, the underground fort offered a soft couch, a warm blanket, and a refuge from the imminent light of dawn. All means of comfort for his pounding head. He crossed the desolate Arrow Drive and trod across the short golden field for the rabbit path, feeling a little less despondent for the deeds he had done, but a little more wary of hostile forces, both lawful and lawless, that were seeking to confront him.